This is Will's Band of the Week for August 4th, 2013. Hello and welcome to another edition of Will's Band of the Week. This is Will, along with Chris.
Here I am.
Barrett apparently is working, and he hasn't really filled us in. This won't be like the Death Grips thing, will it? Did you read the Death Grips thing?
I did not.
They were supposed to play at Lollapalooza, and they just didn't show up.
Oh.
You know, you should show up if you get a gig that big, right?
So they're all signed up to go play Lollapalooza in front of 100,000 people, and it's like, eh.
Right.
Too big of a show, but I did hear that in order to cover for them, they got Fox, which is a Madison band, to plug
right.
that hole.
That was a different band that Fox filled in for, because that band actually told them they weren't going to make it, and then Fox got the call like 2 days before, which is really cool, right?
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
It's great for them. They got like I think it was a noon slot, so it wouldn't be in front of 100,000, but it still could be a solid 10,000.
We need to start a band and just be on the list for, like, we need to be on the to-call list for Lollapalooza just in case.
Right.
In case somebody gets sick or something.
Right. We could say, like, we only need, like, 5 hours' notice.
It can't be too hard to get on that list.
Yeah. well, this is what happened with Death Grips. I don't really follow Death Grips, but they're like one of these, they're like noise rap, I guess. And they, they have a pretty loyal following, I think. And
do they dress up like clowns?
I don't know much about them, but
do they wonder about how magnets work, like the Juggalos? I'm sorry, just keep going.
Apparently they had some after show type thing, and I think some of the after shows are actually before shows, you know what I mean? Like if they're playing on Saturday, they might book a club on Friday night or something. So they had this gig, and then they just didn't show up. And then the fans got mad and trashed their instruments, apparently. Like, there was a drum set up there, and then they announced that they wouldn't be performing. And so, you know, the person at the club announced that, and then the fans decided to smash the drum set. So, and then the next day, on Saturday, I guess, was their Lollapalooza gig, and they just didn't show up. Just not there. So, but you know what? They must have known like a day in advance, because they said there was a replacement band. There was. It was the band that has Shaun White, the Olympic gold medalist snowboarder, is in the band.
What?
Yeah, he's like the guitar player. So they got to fill in for Death Grips.
The Flying Tomato is his nickname, incidentally.
Is that what it was?
Because of his red hair, they call him the Flying Tomato.
That's really not accurate. I mean, it's a totally different shade of red. Come on. It should be the flying rust-colored guy.
That's the problem you have with Shaun White being in a band that plays Lollapalooza?
I guess so.
Yeah. Speaking of Lollapalooza, I actually spent a good portion of the weekend watching it online.
And
The Pitchfork Festival stopped live streaming.
Right. Yeah.
And but Lollapalooza still does it. So I spent I watched The National last night.
You watched The National. That's significant in itself.
I'm still trying to give them a try, because I still feel like I'm on the outside looking in.
Yeah. So how did this performance affect your opinion?
Well, I saw them live in Madison with you guys.
Right.
And it was a show played with instruments.
Yes, that's what you thought of it, yeah.
And, no, I thought it was somewhat entertaining watching it online. They're not really like a middle-of-the-day type of band.
Yeah, that's true of a lot of bands.
I think Gloom works a lot better late at night. But the night before, I watched I spent most of the night watching the Nine Inch Nails.
And how was that?
I saw Nine Inch Nails at Lollapalooza in 1991, the very first Lollapalooza.
Wow.
I was 18 years old and went with some friends to the Lollapalooza in D.C. and saw them there. And that one was Nine Inch Nails and Living Color and Jane's Addiction and the Rollins Band, the Butthole Surfers, Ice-T, Susie and the Banshees. So I was at that one, and then I just thought it was funny that here it is 22 years later, and I'm sitting at home in my basement on my computer watching Nine Inch Nails play on a computer, which didn't even exist back in 1991.
Yeah, wow.
So basically I'm just old. I'm an old-ass man.
Yeah, you're pretty old. Not as old as me, but I'll give you credit for being old.
But I thought it was a pretty good show. I mean, I think they lived up to their headliner status. Apparently, they haven't played live anywhere in like 4 years. So it was a welcome comeback, I think.
That's good. I did know, it occurred to me sometime like Friday evening or something that, oh yeah, they have this live feed from Lollapalooza. It'd be fun to see some of this. So, but I've had kind of a busy weekend, haven't seen very much. I turned it on. It must have been Friday night, and the Killers were on, and I just can't stand the Killers. So I watched it for 1 minute to confirm that I still can't stand the Killers, and it was confirmed. And then yesterday I turned it on and also didn't have too much time to watch much, but I did see a little bit of the Postal Service last night. Do you see any of that?
I didn't see any of that. I kind of tuned out last night because it was mostly after the National. It was like Mumford and Sons and the Lumineers, yeah,
right,
and you know, kind of this genre of band where the guys wear hats, and
yeah,
I don't know, it's just not the, you know, they wear the bowler hats or
yeah,
whatever, and not really my thing. I don't really know much about either of them, so I kind of skipped out last night.
It's hat folk rock.
I watched
like
a movie
that
called The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, which is a 1974 movie with Walter Matthau, and it's got an awesome like 70s soundtrack, like a gritty crime drama soundtrack.
Wow.
It's great. They remade Walter it in Matthau 2009 with John Travolta, and that one's apparently terrible, but yeah.
Hmm. So
that's what I did instead of watching Mumford & Sons.
Well, the Postal Service was pretty good. You know, Ben Gibbard put together a decent band, and they looked like they were having fun, and Grant was watching it with me a little bit, and I commented that Ben Gibbard is a little bit of a nerd. You know, he's a little bit awkward, which kind of I kind of like about him. Like, he dances around on the stage, and you kind of say to yourself, that's kind of an awkward guy dancing on the stage, you know? But,
yeah,
you know, really good songwriter, and I'm sure it was fun for them to go back and play their 10-year-old album, you know, in front of whatever ridiculous number of people in the crowd. So, seemed pretty decent.
I also watched a little set by Ellie Goulding, who I don't know who that is.
Yeah, I turned that on, and here's this woman, and it's like this woman standing there, and then they pan to the crowd, and she's standing in front of, you know, 50,000 people or whatever. It's just insane, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that name, but she must have some kind of a following to be playing like later in the day, right?
It's funny, on my iPhone, I have this Nike where you run and it keeps track of like how far you've run and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And at the end, somebody will like give you encouragement or somebody, usually it's some kind of athlete, like Tim Tebow will come on and go, hey, great run. And Ellie Goulding is one of the people that does it. And I didn't know who it was. I thought she was like an Olympic sprinter or something. So
yeah,
I turn on Lollapalooza and there's Ellie Goulding singing and dancing.
Huh.
I'm like, oh, guess I was wrong.
Maybe she got famous from being on the Nike program.
Perhaps.
It's like being on an Apple commercial. Suddenly you're huge.
Her show was a little underwhelming for me. It was just like basically her on this huge stage. And I'm sure they can't, like, she probably does shows in England. She's English. And she probably has a lot of maybe backup dancers and pyrotechnics or some kind of that. So I imagine on the Lollapalooza stage, they have to kind of quick change in and out, and there's not a whole lot of, backup. The showmanship isn't really there. So basically just her on stage singing and dancing, it didn't really do much for me. But
Yeah, I only saw like 1 minute of it, and it just struck me. One person standing on that giant stage with the crowd is just insane.
Right.
So I do have an update, which contains a correction, and you know, it's rare that we do corrections on the podcast, and the reason for that is obvious, because we usually don't get anything wrong, right? And then, so, of course, there's nothing to correct.
Well, no, it's usually because everything we say is wrong, and if we had to do corrections, it would just be an extra podcast per week.
It would subsume the entire show.
Exactly.
Yeah, it could be that. But I said, I was comparing the Pitchfork Festival to Lollapalooza, and I thought there were 50,000 people at Pitchfork compared to the 90,000 at Lollapalooza. That is way off. That is just ridiculous. I mean, I'm ashamed of myself. The capacity at Pitchfork is either 18,000 or 19,000 per day.
Wow.
And so I must have gotten that 50,000 from some figure that gave the total attendance for the 3 days. And then so I was thinking about just the size comparison. So I wanted to see how big the park was compared to Grant Park. So Union Park, where they do the Pitchfork Festival, is 13.5 acres. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You want to take a guess at how big Grant Park is in terms of acres?
I know I've seen shows there. I'd say it's 2.5 times as big, so we'll go like 30 acres?
Yeah, see, for a layperson such as yourself or myself, that seems like a reasonable guess, but Grant Park is 319 acres.
Oh my
God. It's 23 times the size of Union Park, where the Pitchfork Festival is. So it's crazy. You know, by comparison, Lake Wingra, you know, which is near where we live, is 345 acres, just slightly bigger than Grant Park.
You really did some research.
Yeah,
on this.
I was very curious about these acreages. So, you know, you get 5 times as many people at Lollapalooza, but you do have a park that's 23 times the size. Now, they probably don't use the entire park, but they use a big portion of it. And when I looked on the video, it always looks worse on the video, I think, than when you're there, right? When you're there and you're in the middle of the crowd, it feels crowded, but it's reasonably manageable. But when you look at the video and you see the throng of people, it's like, holy crap, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, you know, when they panned out to the crowd on that feed yesterday from Lollapalooza, didn't it look like people were, like, just packed into, like, half a mile away? It looked insane. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been to a few Lollapaloozas. I can probably name the lineups from, like, the first 4 or 5.
And Lollapalooza was a tour when it started, right?
Indeed, it used to tour the country.
And then it was only, I don't know, when did it become just like the single thing in Chicago? 10 years ago or something?
Yeah,
it was like the first half of it, because I remember it being a tour. I never went to it back then.
They had to cancel it in like 2004 just because of lack of interest. And then I think maybe that's sometime after that is when it just became Chicago only.
Yeah.
As it happens, I did see one of the, when it was still traveling, I saw the Chicago version, I think in 95, where it was like Hole, Sinead O'Connor, Cypress Hill, Beck played a side stage. I found out after the fact that Built to Spill played a side stage, and I just completely missed them. The Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, and I don't know. It wasn't a great lineup, but I remember going down there for a day for that. We walked out on Hole just because Courtney Love is so awful. But I think the Lollapalooza as a traveling entity died when they had Metallica as the header, and I think everybody realized at that point that this is not like within the spirit of what the whole idea was supposed to be like these alternative bands.
I guess Metallica, yeah, they should have been at Ozfest. Wasn't it called Ozfest, the metal thing?
Yeah. As it happens, I watched a documentary about the making Netflix like. Has these documentaries about the making of great albums or whatever. And I watched the making of Metallica's Black Album and how they teamed up with Bob Rock as the producer. And he was such a slave driver, making them do like 40, 50 takes of every song and stuff. So
that sounds good. I don't think I've seen that one. I did see the Metallica full documentary called Some Kind of Monster. Have you seen that one? That's a really good one, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's good because it's not really about Metallica and their music. It's more just about the interpersonal dynamics of the band and all the personalities that how they clash and things like that.
Right.
Yep. I think the my favorite part of that is like, aren't they interviewing Dave Mustaine of Megadeth, and he gets like really into how bad he felt about the bad blood between the bands, and because he got kicked out at some point or something. Or
that sounds right.
Yeah. And, you know, here are these big muscular metal bands, and, you know, you just figure they just thunder through the country and lay waste everyone. But they're actually real human beings and have feelings.
They're sensitive guys, right?
Yeah, they like discussing their feelings with people. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's always a fun contrast with metal. Like, they'll play some super thrash thing, and then they'll be talking. They'll be really soft-spoken, polite. Yep. Yep. So, hey, we have more bonus content this week, don't we? First, I was going to tell the listeners that I watched this documentary called Searching for Sugar Man.
Yeah.
I would bet that some of our listeners have seen it. But if you haven't, I definitely recommend it. And I'll give the basic description without doing too much spoiling. And the reason there's a potential for spoilers in this with this movie, because the whole thing unfolds as sort of an investigation and a mystery, people trying to figure out what happened to this guy, this singer named Rodriguez. And so it just unfolds, and that's part of why it's good, because it just goes along with these people trying to figure out what happened to this guy. But the basic premise is he recorded two albums in the early 70s, and the people who made the albums, you know, producers and all the associated people, just thought they were great, and they were like, this guy's gonna be big, this guy is gonna really hit it big, you know. So the first album comes out and like nothing happens, and then they do the second album, and they're really thinking this one's gonna do it, because this is right up there with all the top level stuff that's coming out today. And you know, a couple months go by and nobody buys it. It's just, so you know, presumably he fades into obscurity. But then, by some random happenstance, he gets really popular in South Africa. And so there's this huge following in South Africa, and literally he's selling, like, I don't know if it was in the... It had to be in the millions or something. Maybe it was like 500,000 just in South Africa, which is, like, ridiculous, right? So the movie is just takes it from there with these people... music critic, nerd type people in South Africa trying to figure out what happened to this guy named Rodriguez. So it's great. You should watch it.
I will. I believe, did it not? It was at least nominated for an Oscar for documentary. I don't know if it won.
Yeah, I think it got nominated. I don't think it won.
Mm.
To win the best documentary, it has to be some kind of war thing, right?
Yeah, it's got to be.
Like it's got to be like there's got to be like real lots of death and stuff. That's my impression.
Not so much the quality of the film; it's the cause which it pushes.
So many times it seems, yeah. So I don't know. I shouldn't be judging. I probably haven't seen all of the documentaries, but this one is right up there. It's really good. Here's a song by Rodriguez. It's called "I Wonder." That's Rodriguez, the subject of the documentary Searching for Sugar Man, which I recommend. And I think you've got something really fun for us today, don't you, Chris?
Well, yeah, there's just you know, sometimes we talk about the movie, or the music industry in general, and just kind of the technological advances that we see. And one of the things that's going on now are these companies that will go out and you can pay them to essentially produce your album. So what happens a lot of time is, like, these teenage girls will go out and their parents, in order to make them happy, will pay money for them to put together like a few songs, because the technology exists now to just crank out albums. And the world saw this a few years ago with Rebecca Black, who did this awful song Friday, which has become like the most lampooned song in the history of the internet, because it's just so awful.
Did it get famous just because of how bad it was, though? I mean, so
yes.
It's interesting how that can be.
Yes. So this might actually be like a strategy now. Like, everybody knows who Rebecca Black is because it's so bad.
Yeah, all it has to do is entertain. It can entertain in any manner, right? By being really good or really bad or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, in the words of Oscar Wilde, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, talk good about me or bad about me, just talk about me.
Right.
So the Rebecca Black song has passed into the lore of American music, and now there's a song by this girl named Tay Allen, and it's called Mass Text. And I just saw this for the first time this morning, and the thing that I immediately thought of is, like, it's just like my ears just found out they were adopted. Like, that's how awful it is. So why don't you play just a little bit of it, just to give people a little bit of a flavor of how this masterpiece goes down.
All right, this is Tay Allen.
Hey, so we've been talking for a while, and I thought we were cool. Did I miss something? Why did I get your mass text? I'm in your contacts. Why did I get your mass text? I'm in your contacts. Why did I get your mass text? I'm in your contacts. Why did I get your mass text? I'm in your contacts.
The party invite made, and you just pretend.
Why did I get your mass text? Why did I get your mass text?
Confused cause I got left out again.
Why not get your mass text? Why not get your mass text?
I like you, this is naughty.
Did you look up anything about this? Like, you know, find out any background?
I know nothing about the song other than the actual text of this song.
I mean, like, I was just thinking, like, whether in fact it was, like, you know, her parents bought it for her or something. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. And there are more like that too, where that's happened. But either this is, I mean, I have several thoughts on this. First of all, this could be the work of just like some genius out there who really knows and like likes good music, but just wants to play a trick on the world. Like, this is a hoax of some kind.
Right.
Like, let's just put together the worst song that we possibly can and see if it can get the same like Rebecca Black effect.
Yeah.
Because it just seems so perfectly crafted to be awful.
Right. Yeah. It could be. We'll find out. Maybe in a couple of weeks, this will have just gone huge. So you're right on top of it, though. Just
right.
Further confirming that we are always on the cutting edge here. We're always on top of everything.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that video of the drumming granny?
I did. The drumming granny in lacrosse.
Yeah. So this woman, and she's like in her 60s. And I guess she was in this drum shop and she just decided to start playing. And, you know, she's kind of rocking. And, but, you know, objectively, she's not really that great of a drummer, it doesn't seem like. But just, it's the sight of a person who looks completely out of context kind of rocking on the drums. And it's got over 4 million views, I noticed. The reason I noticed is I looked it up because a friend of mine got his picture taken with her and put it up on Facebook last night. Like, there he is standing. He's like, here's me and the drumming granny. It's hilarious.
Yeah, apparently she goes into that music store like every few weeks or so and just like starts ripping on the drums.
Right. Yep.
So yeah, you don't see that every day.
Yep.
My final point with the with the Tay Allen situation, the Mass Text song,
mm-hmm.
is that I think you're going to start to see more actually like bands that might have talent kind of move to this type of situation where they go and they pay to have albums made or produced. And so it's just going to flood the industry with a lot of music. And I think it's just going to be a lot harder to pick out the bands that are worthwhile versus the bands that are not worthwhile but have enough money to produce this type of stuff. I don't know. Just the technology exists for anybody to make an album in their basement now. And
yeah, but
I don't know.
That trend has been happening for quite a while.
That's true. That's why you need podcasts like ours to suss out the good stuff, right?
Exactly.
That makes us more important.
Exactly. The importance of us will never go away.
Right. So that's basically the subtext to my whole argument here. Listen to more of our podcast.
Because it's just going to be too hard to navigate the world of entertainment, specifically music.
It's a scary place without us.
It is. Yep. All right, should we proceed to the musical section of the podcast?
Sure.
This is where we're supposed to have transition music, but I don't have it because we're we're DIY. So, yeah, your pick was Michael Cronin. Let's start with that because this album has been out for I think maybe like 3 months now.
Yeah,
and
I think it came out in May.
And I listened to it for a while, and I wasn't enthused enough to like say, hey, we got to talk about this. And then, but then when you told me to listen to it, I got more enthused. I listened to it a couple more times this week, and I think, yeah, it's pretty solid. But you take over and tell us about this.
Well, Michael Cronin is a collaborator with Ty Segall, who I've liked a few albums of. I think he's generally in his band, and then last year they did an album together called Reverse Shark Attack, which I enjoyed quite a bit. I think the fact that those two guys are buddies may explain how prolific each one of them is, because Ty Segall puts out like 4 albums a year now at this point.
Right.
So the album is called MC2, and it's if you like Ty Segall, this is going to be a lot of the same type of stuff. It's kind of surfy pop, pop rock. And I'll just go ahead and play a song to start off with. You'll get the idea of what it kind of sounds like. Let's start with song 3 on the album, which is called Am I Wrong?
Turn it on, turn it on, I'm ready to go.
Michael Cronin posing the question, am I wrong? And answering it, I don't think so. That's good. I like that.
The eternal question.
Somebody must pose the question of whether he's any relation to Kevin Cronin from REO Speedwagon.
Yeah.
And one must then presume the answer is no. I'm going to say no. Can't be, right?
Might be distantly related.
Yeah, you never know. And I don't know how many Cronins there are out there. So, okay, I have two tracks that I was interested in picking, and I was really thinking that you'd probably pick one of them, but I'll pick the one that might be less likely that you would pick. So, okay. And this has a theme, which you will quickly learn. Theme is last song on the album with a piano that isn't bad. And this is the last song on the album with the piano that's really good. So we've got now the Savages album and this album as examples. There might be one other one in there. Do you remember, were you on the podcast where we discussed that? I gave the Vaccines first album as an example of one that I thought was not good.
Yes.
The piano song at the end was like tacked on and not good. But I think Michael Cronin does a great job with the piano song at the end of the album, and it does a really good job of that slow build thing. So I'm gonna cheat. I'm gonna start it like in the middle so you can hear the build part. This is called Piano Mantra. Pretty cool, isn't it?
Sure.
I think he does a great job with a build on that song. And it's got a good melody, too.
Yeah, if you're a fan of Ty Segall, you know most of his stuff is just pretty much balls-to-the-wall rock. But this has some, I was going to make the point, this has some good, you know, kind of instrumental touches. There's some piano, some orchestration in there.
And songs that change in the middle, which is always a good thing, right? When there's a little unexpected thing that happens.
Yeah, there's a lot more going on that you can unpack upon repeated listenings.
Yeah, so we got to play another one, right?
Sure. I'll go with number 7, which is called I'm Done Running From You, which is a little bit more traditional of one of the rockier ones.
It's not enough.
Did Michael Cronin play at the Pitchfork Festival? He wasn't there the day I was there. I'm thinking he might have been there on Friday.
Yeah. The question is, was he in Ty Segall's band when we saw him last year, too?
That's an interesting question, yeah. Yeah.
Because I know the woman that plays drums for Ty Segall also plays drums for Michael Cronin, just because I guess they're all just one big happy family.
Yeah.
Yes. She's very comely as well. And, yeah, so I don't know. I'd have to go back and check my video of the concert last year.
But I was thinking, when listening to this album, that's good music festival music, right?
Right.
I mean, we talk about bands that translate well during the day, during the night, and most rock bands, I think, admittedly, they're more meant for in a club at night, you know, and so a lot of bands just don't. It's just difficult to play in the middle of a sunny day, but this kind of music, I think, it can do it pretty well.
It is sunny music.
And now I did say that last week after you departed on your car trip. Live recorded car trip last week. I think I did make that comment about one of the other bands that had a power pop sound, and I said, you know, they got to get bands like this at music festivals.
Yes. But,
and I was thinking, if I booked a music festival, it'd probably have a lot of power pop in it, but then it would get criticized. People would say, you know, it's totally narrow. There's no variety at all. You know.
Yeah.
So
save the good gloom for a night.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think this album is it's somewhat comparable to like the Waves album that we listened to earlier in the year.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little gentler, a little more melodic. And I should also not get out of this topic without saying that the first Michael Cronin, which I believe came out in 2011, is actually really worth a listen to. So if you're on Spotify or whatever and just dial them up, find it.
And his first name is spelled M-I-K-A-L, so we'll give
yes.
that as a little tip. Yeah,
I actually Googled how do you pronounce M-I-K-A-L name.
It was confirmed that it is Michael?
It was confirmed, yes.
Yeah, good.
So there you go.
He would, if he was McCall, he'd be very appalled at us right now.
Michael, McHale.
I've done that too, like when you don't know how to pronounce something, and you try to Google, and sometimes it's really hard to find, and you're thinking to yourself, wouldn't somebody have like said something? Wouldn't there be a discussion about how do you pronounce this name? So.
Well, especially if you read a lot. I mean, if you know names just from reading things, like
right.
I mean, one of my favorite books is Lolita by Nabokov, but just by reading his name, you'd think it was Nabokov.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually Nabokov.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't know that unless you somehow saw him on TV or something, or heard. Somebody talking about him on the radio.
Right, and we talk about a lot of music that you know, we just don't hear the names pronounced, right? It
took me a while to figure out, like, Sigur Rós, Sleater Kinney. Figured maybe that could be Sleater.
Right, right. Most people would say Sleater, but I think it is Sleater. Yeah. Sigur Rós isn't even right, though, because, I mean, that's as close as you're going to get with, like, an American accent, but it's, like, it's just different if you say it in the native language. I can't do it, but
yeah. I don't think many people really try.
Yeah, that's more than they should expect of us, right? If we come the closest, if we can come as close as possible in terms of the American version, that's what we're gonna do.
Upcoming topic for a new podcast: band names who you can't pronounce just by reading them.
Right. Oh, so and I've got one now. Actually, you kind of can. You kind of can. This band is called Avlov. It's spelled O-V-L-O-V. It just happens to be Volvo spelled backwards. So,
I was unaware of that.
Yeah, yeah. That safe car from Sweden. Is that where they make them? Yeah, Sweden. So I guess these guys like safe cars. But they play rock and roll that sounds kind of reckless. So you'd think they wouldn't like safe cars. And there's an interesting story kind of behind this band. It's three brothers. And knowing my three kids, they would never get along well enough to be in a band together. I mean, that would be like the biggest long shot ever. But so here you got three brothers. They're from Connecticut, and they do rock and roll. And apparently they know the singer for Speedy Ortiz because she does backing vocals on like three or four tracks. So That's kind of cool. And they do this kind of thrashy rock that sounds a little bit like Dinosaur Jr. maybe. Mm-hmm. So, and the album is called Am. So let's play some of it. I'm going to start with a track called New Punk. Avlov. I recommend playing that loud in your car. So, you know, there's loud music that you don't connect with, and there's loud music that you want to turn up. So this crossed the line for me as music that I wanted to turn up.
Yes, as our friend Stephen Thompson says, during the summer there's two types of loud music. There's loud music that you want to roll your windows down so everybody can hear it. And then there's loud music where you want to roll your windows up so it can be even louder.
That's good. That's good.
And I believe that qualifies as the second, the latter. I like that a lot. It kind of harkens back to the Men album.
Right. I thought that too.
Yeah. Yep. Which I liked quite a bit, the last couple of them that I've liked. So, yeah.
Yep. And they do some, melodic... You know, I'm not even going to try to describe it. I'm just going to play it. This one's called Moth Rock. I've got a trivia question for you that relates to this album.
Oh, boy.
Indirectly. Indirectly. Remember the first Surfer Blood album? And it had two songs on it. There was Slow Jabroni and Fast Jabroni.
Yes.
Did you ever figure out who or what Jabroni was?
I thought that was I thought it was like a like an Italian saying for somebody, some kind of slur of some kind, but I'm not sure.
All right. Well, this album has two songs on it. One called "Where's My Dinny," and another one called "There's My Dinny." That's D-I-N-I. And I just stumbled upon this in an interview with them, and somebody said, "Who's Dinny?" And they said, they have this friend. His nickname was Dinny. And the first thing that they recorded, album or whatever, when they made this recording, they did it all instrumentally because Dinny was supposed to be the singer. Because they knew this guy, and they said, he's this great singer, so we got to get him to be the lead singer for our band. and then he, you know, went off and went to school and got a job or whatever, and so they had to do it without him. So they have these two songs on the album, "Where's My Dinny" and "There's My Dinny."
During that explanation, I just dialed up the old Urban Dictionary here, and it says, "Jabroni is really an Italian profanity. It is slang for asshole or dumbass." and the example of the sentence that they give for context is, "Hey, you freaking jabroni, what's the matter with you?" as if that's supposed to provide like all the context you need.
Right, right.
It's just basically a word in a sentence.
Right. Oh, that's good. That you were good. I put you on the spot without any preparation, and you came through. Wow.
It's my training in Latin allowed me to figure it out, to suss out the meaning of the word.
That's good. Very good. Well, I want to play one more from Avlov. It's called "Milk." That's Avlov. It's pretty rocking. You know, it kind of sounds like the guitars are just totally cranked, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's interesting. We should talk about guitar distortion sometime.
I think like, soundscape.
The history of rock guitar distortion. I think that's kind of interesting. You know, there's been the super clean Marshall distortion, which I don't know if clean is even the right word, but the, you know, it's just like really polished sounding. And then and now it seems like now you get a lot more of that just on purpose, really kind of messy sounding. You know who did that first, as far as I'm concerned, is Neil Young.
Mm.
Remember like when Live Rust came out and they needed the Hey Hey My My Into the Black, and the guitar sounded like it was just like just so overdriven that you could only hear like half of the notes being played because it was just completely messed up.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think that's interesting. So this
Watching that Metallica movie inspired me to learn the opening riffs to Enter Sandman, and it's not the same if you don't have like the right effect on the guitar, like the right kind of pedal or whatever they got going.
Totally. Yep.
It's just not the same.
Can't play Metallica songs with an acoustic and have like the same effect, right?
It certainly doesn't sound the same, but it's actually kind of funny, ironic perhaps.
Right.
I don't know. That's kind of all the thing now is to take like rap songs or metal songs and slow them down into acoustic stuff. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll do an Andrew WK song on the acoustic guitar someday.
Yeah, be good. Party has to have the word party in it, right?
Well, they all do.
Yeah.
It's hard to not.
What's he been doing lately?
Well,
I think he was in the news for something like within the last year.
He actually was hosting a kids show that my kids watched called Build, Destroy, Build, or Destroy, Build, Destroy, something like that, where these kids, it's like a game show where these kids have to build something and then blow it up and then try to use it or something. I don't know.
It was,
kind of in the Mythbusters type of vibe for shows.
I think my kids were watching that too. I think I might have been thinking that. Like, it was like something that I wasn't expecting his name to come up in that context.
Mm.
You just never know who's going to show up on TV, do you?
He is a Renaissance man. Hosts kids' TV shows. He parties hard.
Yeah, he does it all.
They're not mutually exclusive, but...
Right.
You know, the guys like on Blue's Clues are partying late at night, all night.
Yeah, nobody ever knows what happened to that guy, right? Steve Burns from Blue's Clues. He was like hanging out with the Flaming Lips, and then he just disappeared.
Sesame Street just turns into an open-air like drug market house party late at night. So they party. Oscar and the boys, Mr. Looper.
Yeah. You just never know what... After the taping is done... On a kid's show, you just never know what these people are doing. It could be pretty wild. Yep. All right. I think we're done. I think we've exhausted everything and told everybody what they need to know until next week. Right? Think so?
Absolutely. Everything you need to know to get through the next week, you have been provided here on this podcast.
All right. Have fun and get through the next week. And we'll talk to you again next week with another edition of Will's Band of the Week. Good night.
Later, jabronis.
You can contact this podcast by sending an email to willsband@yahoo.com or by posting a comment on the webpage willsband.net. You can also contact us through the Will's Band of the Week Facebook page or on Twitter @willsband. You can also, of course, download the podcast on iTunes, the Stitcher app, or any other podcasting app. The Will's Band of the Week podcast is brought to you every week from Fourth Bedroom Studios in Madison, Wisconsin.